Are you finding this podcast enjoyable but looking to enhance your commercial education? Well, we've created an innovative online course that offers comprehensive content. With over 50 lessons available on demand, you can delve deeper into the subject matter. Additionally, you'll gain exclusive access to the valuable online community where you can connect with industry experts. For more information, please visit rethinkcommercialeducation.com.au.
This is a Momentum Media production.
Inside Commercial Property with Rethink Investing.
Australia's largest and most comprehensive podcast covering all things commercial investing.
G'day, how you going? Phil Tarrant, co-host of Inside Commercial Property. Scott O'Neill, Managing Director of Rethink Investing, probably saw when I started that. I got a wry smile. So I don't actually ever know how I'm going to start a podcast. And then I normally just get a thought that is normally a bit cheeky to actually kick off podcasts that I do. But, mate, recently I've been reading the market commentary this last week, and it looks like some people are saying 3 more rate hikes. Scott, I don't know if we should be excited about property at the moment. It sounds a bit dire.
I know. It's amazing the variance between week to week. Mm. You know, we had Nerida on the podcast a few episodes again calling 3 rate cuts. I think it's important to know that over the last 5 quarters, the average CPI is still growing, it's still dropping. Mm. So it's trending down. There's always fluctuations in the data. And I think it's important just not to get too focused on what happens this week and next week, because it's going to change. And any smart investor knows that. But yeah, to be honest, I really don't follow it too much because again,
you really don't? Like, how do you buttress? Because I was reading the papers over the weekend and sort of consuming the media as I do. And I saw this commentary start to come out, and you know, the purpose of today is I want to talk about sort of the future for commercial real estate, you know, predictions for the next decade. But the immediacy and emotions around property investing, whether it's resi or commercial, like I read that stuff and I sit there and I actually go, oh, what's that actually mean? And you get your calculator out, you start sort of working out how much debt you've got and what, another 25 basis point. Like, I can weather it probably better than most, like you can, but there'll be other people sitting there pulling their hair out going, what am I doing? Like, this is bad. This is dire. How do you buttress from the noise to keep consistent with your strategy?
Well, again, I think any good investor that's looking or home buyer right now to purchase, they'd actually be happy with this news because it means there's going to be less investors or home buyers in the market looking to purchase, because I think there's a bit of a general consensus that as soon as this rate drop happens, there's going to be one of the biggest booms we're going to see in a long time, because we've got all these new people in town, we've got not enough houses, the demand has been staggering through all these rate rises, so it's still growing while rates are, you know, as high as they are. So could you imagine when the rates start dropping?
That's a proper glass half full view.
Yeah,
but that's just natural and innate for you. You don't even let these things cloud the fringes, this noise coming out of the media, 3 interest rate hikes, who knows what's going on. There's a problem with CPI, inflation in America, all this sort of stuff. You just go, she'll be right.
Yeah, well, it should be right, but it's backed up with stats. Like, we've seen all the housing markets grow so much. Like, you know, look what's happening in Perth right now.
Yeah.
You know, they've gone up nearly 20% the last 12 months while interest rates have risen. So, and there's just, I guess, the thing I kind of look forward is what's going to change in the next few years. Likely going to be lower rates, likely going to be more people, likely going to be still higher building costs, lots of red tape to build. You know, there's no, the rental market's going through the roof as well. So I really don't see how it could drop in price. And that's kind of the medium-term picture. And look, if rates are, you know, if we saw the housing market come off 20% and, you know, there's general fear out there, I'd be probably talking a little bit different. But yeah, it's a market that kind of has legs in it. And that's why I'm glass half full, because I think logically I can't see it getting cheaper.
So I've got to default to my base position as being a journalist, and I got to ask a question. Oh, you're obviously going to say that because you're in the business of finding people's property, and therefore you're always going to say the property market is good and therefore you should be buying.
Oh, definitely. I would not always say it. And I've said it on this podcast. Well, I've said it a few times. So the point where I'll say don't buy particularly commercial properties is when we see that the rents are dropping long term. Mm-hmm. So you need short term rent drops and also like no kind of, you know, upside in the medium term, because a lot of the valuations are dictated off the rents on commercial properties. So if they're dropping, for example, the CBD office market, rents are falling, in most areas. They're growing in some, mind you, so it's not a uniform comment, but we're seeing the valuations drop because rents are dropping. That's a time where you probably hold back and say, look, I'm better off keeping my money on the sidelines for 12 months or so. But if you look back at history or all the well-known investors in Australia, what have they all got in common? It's that they take action. They take action regularly and they do it with education and they basically, they know what they're doing. They're regularly buying. That's like every person you have on your podcast that's got a good success story, they're regularly doing something. So there's always a market in Australia to do well. It's the one sitting on the sidelines for, you know, decades at a time. You know, inflation will just eat your money up and it's hard to get ahead. So taking action.
So don't hold cash, put it in a property, fight the inflation fight, will benefit from inflationary cycles because you're saying it should continue to put pressure in Australian property. So that's the future. That's what the next decade is. So the big prediction for you, the future landscape predictions for commercial property in the next 10 years is steady as she goes, it's a good safe asset class.
Yeah, I think it's going to be like most maturing markets. You're going to see less people own property. Mm. There's going to be a higher percentage of renters and a lower percentage of people owning more. You know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. It's a horrible thing, but it happens in most capitalist
environments. Is it a horrible thing?
Long-term.
Like, this is a podcast for property investors. I think most of them would acknowledge that it's the nature of an evolving an economy that wealthier people typically get wealthier. Depending where you sit on the political spectrum, you might have different views of that. Maybe back, I would have liked to have met you at university. I reckon you would have been waving a big red flag, hugging trees and all that sort of stuff, mate. But they say you get more conservative with age. So who knows? What's been your, so this is an interesting question. What's been your social bias towards property investment and renting? You would have rented once upon a time in your life. Did you used to see the evil landlords keeping the man down?
I've rented more than I've owned. So like even, we only purchased our family home in 2018 and didn't even live in it immediately. So we were renters, most of my adult life, really. It's only in the last 6 years that we've lived in a house, but then we rented while we built. So maybe I've actually only lived in a house we've owned for about 2 years, potentially. So my big belief is, look, property investing was great for me because it gave me an option to get out of whatever class you want to call it, lower, middle class, whatever I was in, and it got us out. Like without that, I wouldn't have had the opportunities I've had today. So property is that ultimate leveraging tool. You can sort of use a little bit of money to make a lot of money. That's now getting harder. And you could see in the future, it might be 50 years, maybe there won't be that opportunity for the next generation.
So do you generally think it's getting harder to be a property owner? Because it's a big issue and it's shaping the narrative in Australia at the moment, but there are still a lot of young investors. I'm talking resi mainly, but they sort of evolve into commercial property. There's a lot of resi investors who are out there buying their first properties, which are investment properties outside of the place that they live. Is it generally getting harder or is it just different? You've got to do different tactics to actually get into the pathway of home ownership these days.
Well, you're right in what you say. It's different. Mathematically, it's harder because the average income doesn't make as big a dint in house price. So that meant this strategy means you've got to look outside your backyard. You're out into the cheaper capital city markets or the major regionals to buy your first property. But, you know, buying your first property freehold in Sydney, if you live in Sydney, it's probably not going to happen unless you get a big handout.
Yep.
So that worked, you know, for my parents back in the day. You could literally be on a police income or school teacher income and save for a number of years and scrape in and buy a house in Western Sydney and away you go.
Yeah.
It's probably a lot harder to do that now unless you've got no costs, no kids, or all that kind of stuff. Your liability's got to be very low. So strategies are different and I do think it will get harder. It's just because of the immigration thing, the cost of housing, mostly because of bill costs, you know, because remember a lot of the cost of supply has to be delivered by a developer making a margin. If they can't make margins, they've got to charge more or they don't build. So,
labor and building material houses are still a lot higher than what they were comparatively to at the start of COVID. So we're still dealing.
Yeah. And how is that going to come down?
It won't.
Exactly.
It needs to be absorbed or something needs to catch up. So I take the point, it is harder today, but in order to access housing as a wealth creation tool, you just got to apply different tactics to it. And one of them is how you investing in around resi property, but then also commercial property as an enabler for wealth creation. And we've spoken about it at length. This is the episode, was it 48 of this podcast? So we've spoken about pretty much everything to do with commercial property at this point, but this natural rhythm of people to go from being a resi investor and then having a realization where, hey, cash flow is pretty important and or I need to diversify and I'm moving to commercial property. We've spoken at length around that. But have you put much thought to this generational transfer of wealth, which is going to dominate the next decade ahead of us? And what we're talking about there is baby boomers passing away and passing on that wealth to their Gen X and Gen Y children. Mm. They're saying it's the biggest transfer of wealth in probably Australia's history. Do you see any trickle down into commercial property with that or any implications for that? Do you reckon everyone's just going to go out and buy nice big fat family mansions with flat screen TVs and brand new cars in the driveway?
No, it's a great point. And there is a massive transfer of wealth happening in the next 20 years. And I think people are very cash flow conscious. So because of where interest rates are, the cost of living, you know, those who truly feel wealthy have cash flow, not just money sitting in a mansion in wherever, because that's not true wealth. Like, you know, it's like the old aristocrats in England where they've got these big mansions, but they're putting all this money into, their 300-year-old building and they run out of money, a lot of these people. And
I'm watching The Gentleman at the moment, which is, have you seen that yet? The new series, Do Yourself a Favour.
Yeah.
You're talking about exactly those people
that
they make their money in sort of more dubious ways these days. So
yeah, look after the generational wealth through dodgy methods. But there's a huge transfer of wealth happening. And I know most people are really looking at lifestyle as a form of wealth as well. So, you know, if you've got a job that you enjoy that, you know, doesn't feel like work, that's huge. That's wealth. You know, you might have a portfolio that will give you an extra 100, 200K on the side. You know, that's almost the meaning of financial wealth these days. You know, you don't just need $5 million in the bank and, you know, that's it. Because, you'll end up buying silly things and it gets spent that way, like all the classic lotto winner stories. So commercial will benefit, housing will benefit. There's a lot more education around these days, like the amount of podcasts and books and literature out there on residential and commercial now. It's so different from when I first started. You know, we used to have a few forums and a couple of magazines and there maybe been one TV show on it about renovating or something like that at the time. But now it's part of our culture. So I think
There's no excuse now not to be educated in property. If you're going to put the time, energy, and effort in, it's pretty hard to make dumb mistakes if you choose to educate yourself, but people continue to do it.
And people take their education really seriously. Like I was talking to a...
Oh, you've got this new education platform out. What is that all connected in with that?
Yeah. Interesting, a lot of sports people are in that. So, you know, AFL players, A-League players, some of the cricketers.
That's encouraging.
Because they've got this 10-year window of massive earning income potential. And they don't just take the advice of the local financial planner at the club anymore.
Which they used to sponsor the team.
Yeah. And they'll just sell them house and land packages. Like that, they're smarter than that now. And that's why a lot of them, will get actually in a position where they can sort of learn, then they invest. A lot of them are you'll see a lot of them become buyer's agents and all sorts of things. That's a little prediction as well.
It's already happening.
Yeah. And it's just because they know this is going to be their next career. And if they don't sort it out, they'll have to do a job that they don't want to do. You know, like I used to work in the concrete game. One of the main sources of concrete truck drivers were old NRL players down in the Caringbah area. Like, all the St. George footy players, they'd go buy a truck, they'd buy themselves a job, through the agitators. And, their backs were out, their knees were out, and it was still a physical job. And that's the repercussions of not educating yourself or investing well. But you look at, I've seen Paul Gallen in the news. He's been buying sheds up in Tarrant Point and stuff like that. So, and he's probably one of the most wealthy NRL players out there. So he's educated. And I don't know how he did it, but
I'm sure he listens to this podcast. If you're tuning into it, let's get him in. Maybe any of these folks come and have a chat with us on this podcast, be handy.
For sure.
It'd be so the point is around education, and education is a great enabler to help determine how you position yourself strategically in a market where you have little control over its direction. However, if you educate yourself the right way and you deploy the right tactics and strategies, you can do quite well in commercial real estate. So the decade ahead and all those NRL players and footy players and whatever else players who make a big dough at the moment, they should be, and it's relevant whether you do that as a professional sports person or you make your dough some other way, you've got to deploy in your capital today for the best outcomes tomorrow, and that's what the best investors do. So what are you seeing, what are you anticipating with demographic shifts, population growth? I see today in the paper, the government's come out pretty much saying they're not going to do any sort of hard quotas on immigration numbers like they do in Canada. So that's going to be a sort of a grey environment moving forward in terms of population increases, because they don't want to curb what is our biggest export market outside of the stuff we dig out of the ground, which is education. What's going to happen? How's it going to shape commercial markets in a decade ahead? Big question.
Yeah, big question. Well, look, and again, it'll change depending on what government policies or who's in government, all that kind of stuff. But like, it looks like population's going to remain a strong growth contributor to Australia. We're an aging population. You know, there's one of the reasons they want more people to come in is because we've got low birth rates and stuff like that. So there's that transfer of, you know, the baby boomers becoming liabilities onto the healthcare system is going to, you know, create holes in budgets, because you need income producers to help pay for our pensions and stuff like that. So obviously we've got super, and that is a growing consideration for commercial as well. Like, the amount of wealth in super is, it's incredible. And they're just almost just handballing it to, you know, big fund managers, and they're just buying parking money up, really. That's kind of the job they've got, you know, not much more, like just responsible spending of this ever-growing, you know, war chest. But yeah, the aging population, so healthcare, anything like that's going to continually go strong. There's going to be short-term blips to that as well, because I was talking to someone the other day who's in the healthcare sector, and they're finding some of the private health sectors are struggling at the moment due to the fact that people have less spending money at the moment. So, you know, elective surgery or private health, even in the different parts of, medical side of things, they're just basically delaying because it costs a lot of money. So doctors in some cases are not making as much money, and that business model is struggling for the short term. But, you know, you keep piling more people into the system and the quantum will grow as well. So, yeah, it's going to be an ever-growing thing. It's just going to have small little ups and downs in the meantime, like everything.
And we spoke about that. You don't get too consumed with the immediacy of the news you hear today. You've got to deploy the right strategies today for the best outcomes tomorrow. So what do you think in terms of de-risking or de-risk mitigation strategies to where what may be a bumpy ride for the next decade in commercial property, anything which is a surefire way to stay the course and do well?
So one thing I've always done is diversify between states. Because if there's one thing you can never be sure of, is that the current variables of taxes and laws with property are going to stay consistent. And, you know, the negative gearing election was the one to make note. That would have scared most people in property. For me, it didn't bother me, because I actually thought if they abolished negative gearing, that's going to make commercial more popular, because people are going to be less inclined to go resi to go to the commercial. So it could have actually been a good thing for commercial. It would have just made it more in the spotlight as a, you know, a cash flow asset. But you cannot be sure. Like, look what's happening in Victoria. They're changing the rules on stamp duty from July 1, where it's going to be
done
as
50 grand, right? That's a resi.
It's like a land tax type thing. So it's basically, you know, no stamp duty. I've looked at what they've done in New Zealand. We're looking into the New Zealand market a lot these days. And you can see that there are, you know, they did things like you can't claim your interest over there.
That's
like,
getting wound back now. It's staged over the next few years, right?
And it's because the market's been hammered there. Yeah. You know, they had minimum deposits of 40%. They had no capital gains tax. They had, like, there's big differences over there. And it just, like, they're going to start loosening that market up there because it's been punished so hard.
It's a country that's in recession, right?
Correct. And the former prime minister there was quite anti-property, you know, if you want to call a spade. And then the next one's trying to get that going again. Yeah. So you're going to see tides slowly change, but their interest rates are still up towards 9%. So it's a lot higher than us, and their yields are about the same as Australia.
Well, you think about it, right? This next decade, we've got an election next year. So there'll be that election plus probably two more elections within a period of a decade. I think they're talking about maybe four-year terms moving forward, which sort of makes a lot of sense. But you've seen how quickly aptitude and attitudes towards properties change when you have a new government in place. And the predictability of that is impossible to call. So there needs to be an expectation that the decisions you make today may be irrelevant because of changes to legislation or regulation around the tax impacts of, or how you go about investing. Now, a lot of investors feel penalised, both resi and commercial properties, by the current tax regime. And there's a lot of fear in the market. A lot of investors, both resi and commercial, also feel victimised by certain cohorts of the Australian community who label them as evil landlords, and you know, and it's a big deal. So it's a societal community orientated issue today of like the haves and the have nots, which we sort of spoke about. It is a really tough one to unravel, and I pity the governments, whether it's state, federal, or local, to try and balance this, because, you know, I said it at the last election, be careful who wins, because it's going to be a poison chalice.
Yeah.
You're going to have a tough ride ahead. And I think the current government's seeing that, and attitudes towards their ability to manage the economy is starting to wane, right? Because it's hitting people's back pockets. What impact will all of this have to commercial markets? Or do you think largely it'll be the continuity and the strength of those markets will just continue to drive forward as long as business confidence remains?
So my big prediction is it's going to be different for residential and commercial. Mm. Exactly the reasons you said. There's over the next few years, let's just run a scenario past. Let's say interest rates drop. There's the potential the market residential could go up 20 or 30% quite quick.
And over that, what period? Over
a number of years? It could be a couple of years, 15% per annum, because the bulk of buyers are there. Once their lending capacities increase, like, they're going to go, because it's the way to make wealth. Once they, you know, they've seen the figures of the last few years. So again, this is crystal balling, but I think after that growth, there's going to be such a gap between the haves and haves nots. It's going to be a major political issue, you know, and then it might be another negative gearing type thing come in, or maybe they bring some random, you know, extra tax in, or won't let you claim your interest. Like, it happens. And you can't say it will never happen. And the way to kind of get around that is to diversify. And that's like, I think commercial is out of the spotlight. That'll be a lot less pressure on that because it's less political. It's less, you know, there's no talk about capping rent increases and all that kind of hoo-ha that goes on. So there'll be potential risks once the growth happens because they'll need to politically bring it back into line. And that is a risk for me. Mm. I don't know if it'll come true, but that's just my gut feel.
So how do you mitigate or ameliorate those things?
Spread your wealth between different states because they will bring different rules.
And asset classes.
Yeah. You can't just go load up on all New South Wales properties, because one day there might be a government that doesn't like property investors in New South Wales, and then, you know, there might be a – like, they're
already changing land. Well, you've sort of seen that now, right? You've already seen that in all the – because you have a Labor government, most state governments at the moment, and it's easy pickings, property investors, commercial or resi.
Well, look at the land tax scenario. You know, they've just reduced the threshold, up the valuations. Like, that smashes you if you got all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the value of generals and all the different state things is certainly going well.
Yeah.
Property's worth a lot more. What an easy way to increase your income, just by increasing the value of land. Now, and this is the dichotomy that governments need to grapple with, right? Because, you know, they're trying to make houses affordable for everyone, but they're at the same time increasing land value so they can get more in their tax receipts.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure there's some conspiracy theorists around this. Maybe we need a conspiracy theorist to come on this podcast. Tell us what's really going on.
Yeah.
Do I know any? I'll go probably find some.
Well, actually, we've got some good guests lined up. When we're looking to get a demographer on, like one of those futurists.
Yeah, I thought
we haven't done that before, and we'll ask them the same questions we'd want as investors themselves. So if the listeners have any questions for a demographer, this is someone who predicts future, or, you know, how people are going to live in 20 years' time.
Futurist.
Yeah,
one of those. I like future. I like talking to futurists. And I've got a whole bunch of questions I want to ask you a little bit later on, because we've curated a whole bunch of questions that have been coming through the social feeds, mainly Instagram. What's your Instagram handle again, if you want to follow you?
Is it Rethink Investing?
Yeah, there you go. I think I follow it. There's always you there talking about stuff normally on this podcast. So I've got a whole bunch of questions as well, but that would be good. And we've had a lot of guests recently, so it's the first time me and you've got together just solo, and a lot of the feedback is they like us just chatting about predictions, what's going on, because people are still trying to orientate themselves with all this noise out there, and we're talking sort of a decade. Need to remember, property investing isn't about today or tomorrow or decade. It's a long-term wealth creation strategy, so you should be thinking multiple decades.
Yeah.
I guess you probably a little bit more than me, but we're both fortunate enough that we started investing in property earlier in our working lives, and we've probably still got quite a few decades ahead of us to reap the benefits of that decision-making. But again, it comes down to how do you balance your strategic and tactical decisions in an environment that you have very little control over the predictability of markets? And we've spoken about what's happening in the government, what's happening federally with taxes, how that's going to shape and positively or negatively influence the direction of commercial markets. There's a whole other aspect to this, and it's the, you know, what's happening globally and what is the impact or relevance of that inside of Australia. And, you know, we sort of got through the COVID pandemic and then this whole sort of spate of world crisis come up. We've got the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, which still continues to hamper supply chains and the cost of goods. A lot of this has an application in it's more expensive to live here. We have the conflict in the Middle East. We have rebels blocking up the Red Sea, making it more expensive for shipping because they've got to go around the long way rather than through the Suez. We have the crisis in Gaza, Israel, Palestine, choose whichever word you want to use, depending what side you see or how you see the world. There's a lot going on strategically, and not only inside of that, our own backyard with some of the great sort of tensions that we have today in relation to geostrategic issues between Taiwan and China and Australia's roles and responsibilities there. Like, it's a big deal, you know, and if you looked at all that sort of stuff, you'd never invest in commercial property because you go, you know, Chicken Little, the sky's falling in.
And what's the most interesting part of, you know, dozen items you just mentioned is what did it do to the property market?
Yeah.
It made it increase. If anything, it's the inflation.
But no one can explain why, because everyone sits there saying the same thing. All this is happening, but property keeps going up.
I think the logic is Australia's a safe haven country, you know? So like the more that goes on in Europe or the US, like the one thing that would threaten it would be a China war because it's closer to us. You know, that would make, you know, it's like the waterfronts in Sydney Harbour after World War II were cheaper because people are worried about attacks and submarines and all sorts of stuff like that. But those wars over there, if anything, it pushes more people to want to live here, invest here. Stability of Australia and places like Canada and stuff like that and New Zealand as well is always going to come to the top, I think, for the general consensus.
Well, yeah. I think we're speaking about before Bernard Sol, who's a demographer, talks about the Dubai effect, where in the Middle East all the money goes into Dubai because it's a safe and stable place where people who live in the Middle East can park their dough.
Yep.
They say Sydney, Melbourne, and now Brizzy, same application inside the Asia Pacific. It's where Asia's wealth goes if you want to protect it because of the strength and the resilience of our political system here, the strength and resilience of our allies and alliances globally to ensure the protection. The fact that also it's a nice place to live.
Yep.
This is a good thing for commercial property.
Yeah. 100% and makes total sense.
That could be your new book, you know, The World Today and What Does It Mean for Australian Commercial Property. You've probably got another book in you, haven't you?
Oh, no, not for a few years.
No?
How's
the book going? Is it because we did a podcast doing the second iteration of it.
Yeah, no, it's good. We got told it's the best-selling book on commercial of all time by a factor of five.
Is it really?
According to Wiley. So
okay.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but I just did. But yeah, no, it's good. It's up there.
It's because no one else has written a commercial book probably before.
Oh, there's a couple out there. Yeah.
It's the only one you need to read, right?
Exactly. No, but it ranked really well. And feedback was good. It's just our take on commercial property. It's an intro. It's got some good stats and stuff in it. But if you have never considered that asset class, people read that and you will consider it forever after that. Whether or not you'll buy it, it's totally an individual question. But
yeah. So you're still selling it. You haven't got a warehouse full of them. You're trying to give them away for nothing. You'll just pay for the postage. You can actually still go and buy it.
Oh, we give a free one out with the education course. But okay. It still sells on Amazon and all that stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. I read it.
Yeah. Oh, you did?
I did. Well, I skimmed it.
Yeah. I'm surprised you had the time.
I know. But I'm a big reader.
Books?
I'm a big reader.
Really?
I skim property books, but I probably still get through 2-3 books a week.
Because I'd struggle reading property books, to be honest. And same with you, you're in this all day. It's just someone's opinion for 300 pages. But that's just because we're in it 12 hours
in
a
it.
Day.
Yeah, yeah. I don't, you know, people just go, oh, you must love property, Phil. Is that all you know? It's not. When I'm not talking about property on podcasts, I sort of skim stuff and I'm interested in it. I get a lot. Everyone always sends me their book when they do it and ask me the review that I don't review. I normally skim it and just go, it's pretty hard. Yeah, property, and this is the point. There's no real secret strategically on how to do property well. It's all about the execution.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can't really, there's no new grand scheme secret way to make wealth through property. You know, property is boring. And it should be boring. You know, you buy the right stuff, you hold on to it for a long time, it'll go up in value, and then that gives you a choice at a point in time what you do with that dough.
It's so true. And like you see it in this new generation of buyer's agents, everyone's got a new like hot thing, whether it's data or hotspots or, you know, flipping or, you know, there's always a quick rich angle. And you're right, like a lot of these people that go buy in sort of some of the more rough markets of the country, it can become a self-sufficient prophecy. You know, if you get 50 buyer's agents all buying in the same area of Adelaide and it pumps it up quickly. Like there can be really good growth just created from the buyer's agents. And And that's where the long-term wealth effect is so important, because once that sugar hit's gone, maybe the rents of that value or the overall wealth won't account for all the new wealth the buyer's agents have brought in. So, you know, this is just, again, a third angle, probably a bit controversial to say, yeah, maybe that's not the best strategy as well. Like it's you've got to look at the long-term growth rates of property. You've got to have the right cash flow. And there's no real secret sauce. Like you just need to negotiate well. Don't buy in a suburb that's declining in wealth, or, you know, one of my favorite growth types of growth is, you know, when a suburb's revitalized, you know, basically improving itself, you know. So it's going from like the Redfins of the world.
Gentrification
is the word I was looking for. So that is that's a great growth driver, because that new wealth will give you above average rental growth, and homeowners are coming into that market. If you can find those markets, that's one of the keys.
And it's basic, right? It's like business today. You know, you speak to anyone in the startup land, they reckon it's impossible to raise capital. Capital's hard to get hold of, because the heady days of, hey, I've got a great idea and I'm going to do all this growth quick, give me some dough and I'll show you how to do it. Like business, like property, should be boring. You know, it should be about making profit rather than, hey, let me have this unrealistic growth story to try and influence people to invest in it in a company that never makes money.
Yeah.
Same applies in property, but commercial property is intrinsically connected. And we spoke about this through COVID, and this was very much a narrative that commercial property is intrinsically connected with business in Australia. You know, commercial property by its very nature is connected with housing, some sort of commercial operation for some sort. So, you know, the consumer preferences of how people are buying and selling stuff in Australia, how they choose to shop, how they choose to spend their money, whether or not they've got money. You spoke about healthcare. You know, it's an interesting application of saying, hey, doctors' business model is under pressure because less people are getting elective surgery. So, you know, no doubt you've got a lot of doctors that invest in commercial property. Maybe that's waning. So everything is interconnected with the economic cycles and the health and aptitude and attitude towards business sentiment. Do you see that remaining the same moving forward? It's just going to be fits and starts. One day it's going to be sentiment's low. One day it's going to be high. Commercial property will be influenced or impacted how?
Well, look, it's a good point you brought up, because like you would have known that a lot of those venture capitalists are actually investing more in property because, you know, the milk runs of the world where there were huge valuations on companies that were losing large amounts of money. Mm. Like that, we've seen the demise of that. Australia's not used to that. The US is a lot more, but us Australians are a lot more conservative. So property is our choice, a vehicle, not a 1 in 10 chance of a 10x type opportunity in a company that may or may not work. So the good thing about commercial property is it takes kind of the market average of the core businesses of Australia. So they're your supermarkets, your warehouses. Like they aren't the tech startups that quickly build a city. You know, these are department stores and things like there's track record. You know, you can see long-term trends. There's a fair bit of data out there, and you're just buying the leveraged asset associated to those businesses that has a bias towards cash flow, which is exactly what you need in a higher interest rate environment.
How closely do you think commercial rents will run compared to the cost of debt moving forward? Because I know a lot of people, when we started this podcast, we're now 46 episodes in or whatever it is, there's a lot of free cash flow in commercial property, less so today. Should, for the next how many years, should people have an appreciation that you're probably going to be pretty close to neutrally geared if you're buying commercial property at 7% for the next period of time? How long do you need to have an acceptance? That's the way it's going to be.
Well, this is another one of my big predictions is, as we were saying earlier in this podcast, it's going to get harder for residential investors because cost of building and all that goes up. There's more people fighting over less product, essentially. Long term, that'll happen with commercial. I'm sure of it, because there's just a huge residential market that may consider commercial more and more. So it's 600,000 purchases per year, commercial's 20,000. So like I've said before, imagine if 50,000 new commercial investors come out of residential. The demand ratio is through the roof. So
those numbers, there's 600,000
residential transactions per annum.
Every year in Australia.
Commercial, 15 to 20,
it's
25.
Tiny, isn't it, really? And most of them, you probably do most of them sub certain amount.
All price points, and this is like just data off, you know, the government website. So that might include vacant lands and all that kind of stuff. It's basically title. So, you know, exactly what those 20,000 are. You know, we brought up the stats a couple of podcasts ago that there's only about 2,500 tenanted properties under 10 million per annum listed online. Then you've got your off-market sales, your vacant sales, development sites.
Yeah.
So it's a tiny little world. So that, for that reason, I think there's going to be more people flow into it. because, you know, the top 1% will target it more. People will, and to answer your question direct, I think the margins will get thinner long term because there'll be more capital growth, and people will see it more as a capital growth product because, you know, we're busted that myth. I think anyone that's owned commercial property ever busted that myth themselves because they go, oh, look, my value went up.
Yeah.
And that's going to be an opportunity for those who are in the market. And it's a growth product as much as a cash flow. So you don't need that 2 or 3% margin on the interest rate to your cash flow. You know, you don't need an 8% return and you've got to have an interest rate of 5% to make it justified. That's a bonus if you're getting that type of return. But, you know, a lot of people are putting large amounts of cash into it. So what's the cash rate? You know, 4.25, you know, as long as you're getting more than that, the property's growing in value, you're getting the rent growth every year. It's
you're ahead of the game.
Yeah, you will be ahead.
So how closely will commercial, you're speaking about capital growth inside of commercial. So what your predictions is that commercial property over the next decade and beyond will probably increase in terms of its historic speed of growth at a capital rate. How closely will commercial assets emulate residential price growth in areas where residential prices are growing? And I think about you guys sort of secured me a property in Perth, big sort of, yep, you know, major industrial area of Perth, probably 3 years ago now, yep, probably around that. Like, would that be growing at the same speed as the residential market there?
Yeah, look, commercial generally grows at a similar rate, which we've seen in the book as well, which it's about 1% less over the last 30 years. You know, so if resi was growing at 7% per annum, we found that most commercial investment classes were about 6%. In your Perth example, there's less transactions that happen. So this is a pattern we've noticed over the years. Residential goes first, then commercial follows slowly after because there's less transactions. And again, it's a different price point. So there's just a whole lot less data to refer to. So it's less instant. But it really goes back down to the old land value side of things and build costs. It still costs the same to build a commercial property within reason if it's the same quality as residential. And the land is going to be what the land's worth. And, you know, we have slight variations between industrial to high-rise resi to low density. So basically the land grows as per, you know, its zoning as well, but it will grow slower. But the Perth industrial market's had an absolute flyer these last few years. So to answer your question, yes, it's grown. I don't know the exact figure off the top of my head, but it would not be far off and it's still going. So there's a lot of rent growth happening there at the moment. That'll get passed on to the capital value as well. So yeah, it follows a similar trajectory, but slower.
Well, you just set me up to ask you a question, which is based on some of the questions that we have here. And you can send questions through just, what do you like, DMs on Instagram? Is that the best way to get questions if that's how people want to do it?
Yeah.
But before we get there, and it's connected with this question. So in resi property, there's this big debate around investing in houses versus investing in units. And we're at this moment in time, and I'm thinking Sydney, for example, but it's probably relevant elsewhere, where the discrepancy between unit prices and house prices as wide as it has been. Usually they grow at a similar speed, but there's a big gap between houses and units at the moment. And therefore, a lot of people are saying, hey, units in Sydney is a good purchase and it's where most people can afford these days, et cetera. But they're saying they're less attractive investments because it's a strata environment and you're only getting a share of the land that's connected with it. Most, inverted commas, well, a lot of commercial property purchases are essentially inverted commas units, right? If you're buying in an industrial estate, you're buying a tenanted complex where you own a portion of the land and other people own other parts of the land. You don't actually hold an unencumbered freehold access to 100% of the properties. Does the same thing apply? Do commercial single dwelling, single holding properties perform better than tenanted or strata units inside of commercial?
Look, very long term, there is an argument to that because obviously buildings depreciate. Look, there's two big differences with that analogy you use. So units in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, they're generally high rises. So there's a lot of supply of them. That's a lot less attractive compared to, say, a townhouse that might be part of a community scheme. Like, so there's less overheads. You know, a unit in Sydney would be similar to what I'd say an office building would be because it's high rise. It's the supply issue. The one good thing about commercial is that the tenant will pay the outgoings generally. It's factored in to the net income. So that's a killer for residential, especially these big towers that age. You know, all of a sudden the strata can become crippling in time and it does make it less attractive. That one factor is one of the reasons it doesn't grow as quick. But remember, freehold, you've got to put in a lot of your own cash. Like, this is one of the things I've always kind of said that they miss with the residential capital growth rates, like using Bellevue Hill as an example in Sydney, which is sort of topping the average value in Australia at the moment. Most people would spend $5 million plus on a knockdown rebuild on a small house, sometimes up to $10 million. That all gets factored in on the average sale price when they transact. So there's a lot of money that gets put into that actual dollar amount at the end of the day. And units, like, they will age, but you will have a lot of your maintenance trapped into the, you know, external maintenance of the strata. So strata's not all bad. It's still got your building insurance in there. It's still got your external maintenance. The things that aren't good are things like lifts and swimming pools and all that kind of stuff, because you're not going to get that money back in growth.
Yeah. So is most of the properties you buy strata-based commercial assets? Like, there'd be a lot more of them for sale than what there would be freehold single dwellings, right? There's not a lot of single dwelling commercial properties around, or some.
But. Yeah. No, good question. I'd rethink. It's probably about 30, 35, 40% of the properties we buy are strata.
Okay.
So most of the good stuff under 2 million will be part of a strata, because if you've got a freehold asset and it's in a great area, it's probably going to have a dumpy little shed on it that you've got to knock down. So above 2 mil, it's generally freehold.
Freehold.
It's a price thing. And you want the best dollar for dollar property you can buy. And like what you bought, an industrial shed in Perth, the strata is simple. It's a common road. Yeah. There's external maintenance. There's insurance. You would have paid for that anyway. You're just sharing the average of all the warehouses in that small complex. So strata can be great in commercial. It's just you don't want to go buy up into a, you know, a 40-year-old office tower that's, you know, got to be
falling apart with their old air conditioner still in the window, right? They're around.
I know. And the cost, like just to replace the windows on a tower, could be tens of millions on some of the biggest ones. So yeah, huge costs that need to be factored in long term.
So you spoke about diversification. I want to get to these questions, but I'm going to ask the first question. Speak about diversification. So on that point, would you be better off two $1 million commercial assets under a strata environment in two different geographic locations, or a freehold, wholly owned asset, singular, worth $2+ million in a single location? It depends.
Yeah. I'm going to give that really boring, you know, a both way type kind of answer that. Yeah. It depends on your situation. If you've got a large residential portfolio, or you're a very stable job, like a, you know, you're a medical professional, yeah, go buy the $2 million asset any day of the week, because you're going to expose yourself to a better quality asset. If you're a first time, or, you know, you bought two or three small properties and you're still working your way up, yeah, buy the $1 million property. Then you could diversify into another state, another tenant, because your tenants will go. Don't come into this thinking you're going to get your tenant forever. And I can tell you, even the most experienced investors, when they get their first vacancy, like it rocks them a bit.
Yeah.
It'll rock you. It rocked me when it happened. It's just part of life. It's exciting when you replace them, because it's like you got. It's almost like you got a new property. You got this new business in there, and all the upside, or, you know, security that brings with it is it's a relief. It's potentially upside. But if you've gone and leveraged up too much, and you've already stretched yourself for that big $2 million asset, and that goes vacant, it's not going to be a fun day at the office. You'll lose sleep over it.
But you typically can telegraph changes in tenants. Right. Like, it's not like someone calls up today saying, I'm out of there in 30 days or 21 days, whatever it is, right? Like, you normally have time on your side to make a replacement.
Correct.
And if you buy the, again, back to asset selection, you've bought the right asset, you should be able to get someone in there and have continuity of your rent.
Yeah, look, we've been buying commercial property for 10 years now. And so obviously I'm talking to lots of clients that have upcoming vacancies, current ones. And we've seen that on average, they probably get a 9-month window.
Yeah.
So that's when the tenant starts talking, or they'll try to break their lease early, and then you've got to remind them they can't, or maybe you sublease it. It's amazing. Like, and when you're in those situations, like, you've got to be patient. You can't force it. You need the right tenant at the right time that needs the right size property similar to yours. It doesn't just happen. So you need just to, you know, put the bait out there, get all the ads up, have the best photos possible, give it a clean slate. Like, a lot of tenants don't want to look at a property until the tenant's out. So even if you get 9 months head start, if they've still got their old fit out and all, you know, their stuff in it, it's not attractive. They'll just go to one that's already cleaned out. So, you know, don't expect it to happen straight away. But once the tenant's out, your percentages of filling it go up quite quickly. And yet, look, sometimes the economy changes as well. You know, like if you bought office, or, you know, there's a cost of living crises are causing longer delays in somewhere, because new businesses don't want to just jump in until there's more certainty. So I think you'll see when rates drop, there'll be a lot more confidence in business as well. So if you've got like a retail vacancy there and it's been a bit sticky to fill, it might be a case of not much will happen until that kind of macro news changes.
Mm. So everyone wants, well, most people I know want capital growth inside of their commercial property as well as a cash flow play. And one of the questions here, and please send them in, just put them in the notes of this podcast, any of the reviews or even through Instagram where a lot of these questions have come through on Rethink Investing. Sort of to my point earlier, is there data available? And we'll go through these really quickly so I can bang through some. Is there data available showing capital growth for commercial property? It's a lot harder to find.
Yeah. So unfortunately, there's only data at the top end of town. Mm. So your Knight Frank reports, CBRE, Colliers, if you just Google annual reports, you'll see quarterly reports actually for industrial, office, retail, and they generally only cover Sydney, Perth, Melbourne, Brisbane.
So like, the major markets. You don't go sort of sub-regional
stuff. But you wouldn't even be able to get, sub-regional. You wouldn't be able to get Canberra. You wouldn't be able to get Darwin. Like, it's quite...
Why is that? Because resi property, there's data for everything.
It's just not enough transactions.
Because there's only 20-odd thousand a year.
Yeah, and a lot of the... Again, they're focusing on the top end of town. Like, this is for super funds and stuff like that. So that's why we had to manually get the data. And, you know, we had to basically get the slightly equivalent of RP data. It costs like, 15, 20 grand a year, and you've got to just manually get the square meter rates for sale prices and compare it for like buildings that bought and sold, and then you've got to compare the fit outs at the time. It's pretty backbreaking stuff. It's manual.
And that's how you work out what you put in for offers for certain places. So, because you've got to do it mechanically, right? It's not, I think it's worth this much.
So it's very easy to work out the current sale prices because you can just almost get them from agents and stuff like that. We have our own internal data, and obviously every time a client buys, there's a valuation we've got in our hands. So, you know, we've got a stockpile of those to refer to. But what's really hard is trying to find the valuation of that property 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
You don't know.
You literally got to dig it up. And that's why I get asked by a lot of people, is there a data house that shows this? And economically, there will never be one because there's no business model that will allow someone to regularly update that, like, unless you're selling it for 10 grand a pop, I guess. So that's why, like, I've looked into it. Do I make a data house? And, you know, unless you're just manually updating rents, like, you're only going to get short-term results. Mm. And there's not much value. Residential, it's amazing. It's great. There's five different versions of this. But, again, it's a bit of a mysterious, low-volume world that's often not put down on paper.
There's a reason why people use buyer's agents like you to buy commercial property, right?
Yeah, and the trick is just that regular buying. Like if I took a 12-month break, just getting back into it would be hard because you'd have to literally manually go, what did that sell for? You know, has that got a valuation? Is that agent telling the truth? It's just an accumulation of current data.
Agents always tell the truth, don't they? I see on the, the governance or the efficacy index recently, real estate agents still come down the bottom of the most trusted professionals.
Oh, I know. There's some stories for a rainy day I can give you. There's another time. That I've heard.
So other questions here. This is a good one. And how much cash do you need to have $2 million in net cash flow per year? I imagine that is how much equity do you need to have $2 million in net cash flow per year by having commercial property? It's probably what that question is.
Yeah. So it's a big number, $2 million net cash flow. If you've got that, you're doing very well. So let's just assume you're buying a 7.5 mil asset because you can definitely do that. You might buy two shopping centers, 7.5 each. Yep. You would need two $30 million shopping centers. So 60 mil total value. That would give you 4.5 mil in income. And then you've got to minus your mortgage. At the current mortgage rates, you're looking at about 2,600. That's based on a 6.25%. You wash all the other costs out there. You're looking at just under 2 mil for that. So
60 million in asset value, and how much debt on that?
That'd be 70%. So you'd be looking at, you need about 20 mil cash to get that.
Okay, so go put 20 million cash in to get 60, to control $60 million of value with 70% debt.
And that'll
generate you 2 million net.
Yeah, that's after mortgage, after all outgoings. But look, running in the same
scenario. That's your average client, isn't it?
Oh, not quite. There's a few a lot bigger than that, mind you, as well.
Like so how normal would that be, 60 million in commercial? That's a lot of money. That's like sort of family office money, right?
Family office. Yeah. So they're out there. A lot of them are just exactly family offices, entrepreneurs that have kind of been, you know, third generation business type people. They're out there they're a handful type number.
Okay. So if you want $200,000, you need about $6 million in in asset value.
But interestingly, if you sort of run that same scenario off an interest rate of 4.25%, you only need $45 million in property.
Okay.
So that just shows how much the interest rate influences.
And but that would be today, right? If you fast forward 10 years, we're talking about predictions of 10 years, right? That $60 million is going to be very different. If you keep your debt level the same,
yep,
and based on sort of interest rate increases, that would change. I wouldn't know. I couldn't do those numbers off the top of my head, but I reckon you would probably be, in 10 years' time, you'd be close to at least another 50% on that in terms of income.
Yeah, easy.
Yeah.
So like, you know, that's just 4% compounding each year. We'll give you roughly that 50%.
So this is the point around accumulation versus, you know, the management phase of your, so accumulate as quickly as you possibly can.
Yep.
With the immediacy of how much cash you can generate to actually control the assets, buy the right assets, and then sit around and wait.
Yeah, and it'll keep happening. And then your value add strategies, you're probably going to chuck in a little development on one of those
solar on the roof.
All of that.
100%. Sell some advertising on the side of the building.
Yep.
Yeah.
Battery storage, that's the new thing.
Battery storage.
Huge margins in that.
Yeah.
We'll get someone on to talk about that one day too.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a big deal to generate $2 million in net cash flow. But there's people out there doing it.
Yeah. And if you've got that level, you're probably going to have your own in house. Like you're basically a fund manager.
Yeah.
I know one client that's got more than that. And, you know, he basically was a tech company, sold it for huge money, hundreds of millions of dollars, put it into commercial debt-free, and now he's getting investors to fund half of it. So he's doubling the size of it.
So that's his new business is
it's going to be a fund manager. He's got the property managers in place. So that's how a lot of fund managers start too. Mm. You know, they've got personal wealth and they get their mates into it. And then you get third parties after that.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of governance and compliance around it when you do that. It's not just, hey, mate, let's do this together. But this is like people talk about property syndicates, right? Like that's all really a fund manager is. It's a syndicate of accumulating wealth and then deploying it the right way. So, you know, if you invest with someone else, you're essentially a syndicate. If you invest with your wife and or your husband or your partner, you're in a property syndicate. There's two people in that syndicate.
Exactly.
This is what most people don't understand. Most Australian investors or own occupiers invest as a syndicate.
Yeah, true. Yeah. And just bigger syndicates have more fees. That's really the difference.
And they make more money.
Exactly.
But, so what would be normal? Like, I don't know if you can help me out with this, but what would be a normal client for you? Like what sort of net cash flow would they be generating? And it's always hard because you're going to be, well, how far through their property journey are they? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But what's normal if we can do that?
Oh, to give you kind of really accurate stats, like the average lead off the internet would have about $350,000 cash deposit.
Okay.
That's the internet.
Yeah.
The word of mouth, because most clients will refer, you're looking more than double that.
Okay.
And then you've got the whales on top of that. So, yeah, you know, so we're word of mouth, probably an $800,000 deposit.
Yeah.
And then you just got business to business stuff and all that kind of stuff, which would be, you know, seven figures plus of deposit. Yeah.
So 800K, so someone coming through your network, whether it's someone listening to this, become a client, tell their mates, et cetera, would a lot of that be sort of unencumbered outside of super? A lot of it's still super dough?
Unencumbered out of super. So okay. Or it could be refinanced from resi. So that's going to be a big one in the next few years. Like so people, you know, as all this residential growth happens, again, the delayed effect, it comes into commercial because people go, well, look, I got my $5 million residential portfolio. I've got 30% equity in it now that I can pull out, you know, use that to then buy a commercial because even at 100% debt, you're still going to cover yourself. You know, if your interest rate's 6.5%, you need to probably go get a 7.5% net yielding asset to justify that the risk.
And one of the questions here, I was going to leave it for next time we got together, but it's connected with this, is I have a real estate investment with about $200,000 in equity, push on to a commercial with that equity. So, you know, we're not offering any advice to anyone in this podcast or any podcast who does. This is obviously a very general chat. And if you're going to make investment decisions, you need to speak to a qualified and trained financial professional. Apologies for the disclaimer, but you got to do these things every now and then. Refinancing your residential investment properties, and you sort of spoke to it, to chuck that dough into commercial rather than resi again.
Yeah.
Good time to be doing it.
Look, again, it depends how many residential properties you've got. Like if you've got one residential and you're still on your way up, probably go buy another one or two. Yeah. But don't get stuck just doing that residential, you know, one after the other, because there's so much attention from mostly buyers agents saying, keep buying it, because that's their business model. They would love you to buy 10 houses in Logan, you know, but there's a point where
Why do you hate Logan so much?
I don't. I've bought in there. I've got three properties still.
I've got a property in Logan.
but Logan's an area that it got targeted by a lot of, and I think it will keep doing well statistically just because there'll be a lot of people wanting to invest in slightly cheaper houses. Mm. So there'll always be a demand for that product. But the trick is don't just keep buying them because it's like, you know, it's not an achievement just to keep buying more and more of them because you're going to get yourself into a cash flow hole.
Yeah.
And you won't know it until it's too late because there'll be a change in policy or the banks will tighten them up or there's an economic stress point where they don't like investors with 10 loans. And like I've seen it before. You know, when I first started, there was an investor that I knew he had about 100 plus properties in Logan. By the end of the GFC, he had 30. So he
just selling off.
Yeah, no, he got pummeled. So, yeah. And that's because the banks tightened the rules on him. So I've always remembered that lesson. Just don't go all in one area.
100 properties in Logan.
Yeah. He lived there and he was just smashing them out. It was back in the days where you could literally just refinance off a bank valuation and go again and again and again.
Yeah.
Doesn't work.
The good old days.
The house of cards.
Good old days. Yeah. And you could just call up and go, I want to extend my interest.
Yeah.
Interest only, right? Now you got to do a whole new application.
Yeah. And all this. Wild West.
The Wild West.
Yeah.
The Wild West. Final question here, and there's some really good questions here, so thanks everyone for sending them, and please keep doing them at Rethink Investing on the Instagram. When purchasing a commercial property, how important is it to understand CPI increases and tenant scheduling? Well, we covered CPI increases, but I think people need to actually, so CPI being, you know, what's going on with the consumer price index externally, what that means to prices, but how do you actually lock in a connectivity with your interest rates around that? Is a key thing. Do you like a review, a sort of structured review per contract at 4, 3, 4, 5% or CPI every single year?
Yeah, look, ideally you go CPI or 4%, the greater of. That's kind of like the best case. But I think it's important just to understand what, say, 4% actually does to rent because a lot of people go, oh, the rent's gone up 4%. If you've got a $2 million commercial investment, 4% on that income is actually 80 grand equity. So every 4% you get, on a $2 million asset base is 80,000 in equity you get, and that compounds over time. So it's extremely important to maximize your rental increases. Give yourself the chance to increase the rent if you can.
So you're saying every time you increase the rent, you increase the value of that property because it's inherently connected with the cash that it's generating.
It happens instantly. So the rent goes up, the value's gone up via value of definitions.
So your example there was on what, a $2 million?
Yeah,
property
$2 million.
Goes up 4%, so it means you're adding $80,000 in equity on the property.
Yeah, significant.
Yeah.
So,
that equity, like if it just sits there, it's lazy equity, but you know, a bank would value it on the basis of that, so you could extract that equity if you wanted to.
Exactly, and that's why you know, industrial, the last four quarters, the rents have gone up nationwide. It was about 10.5%. So, you know, they've made $200,000 just on rental growth. You know, for the average industrial asset, so it's it's a really good return on equity, and that's just by increasing the rent. That doesn't happen with residential. There's a bit of an indicator of increasing rents will show future capital growth, but not like commercial. It's kind of, like you said, inherently locked together. It's structured that way. So if you can find under-rented properties, that's the easiest value add you can get in property in general, I think, because it's on a spreadsheet. You know, you don't have to guess your way to what a bathroom renovation is going to do to, you know, the aesthetic appeal to a house or an owner-occupier. It's just rent goes up 5%, the value goes up 5%.
In a residential scenario, manufacturing equity typically involves spending money on a reno, whereas in commercial property, manufacturing equity is about increasing the rent structurally. So you look for this when it comes to the value of an asset, when is it under-rented and when that lease is due for renewal. That's a key indicator whether or not someone's an attractive investment.
Yeah. So when we present a property to a client, we always have the comparable rents in there, day one. So you can see where the rent stands. Like, and it's okay if it's slightly over and it's a longer lease or, you know, you're getting a good yield. But if it's way under, you can afford to pay more for that property because you know there's a big payday coming. And it might be at the end of the lease. The lease might be 5 years away. So it's a long wait. You know, I recently purchase into a syndicate with a couple of mates in a property in Tasmania. This was about a $10 million property. The rent was 40, maybe 45% under-rented.
Okay.
But it's a 9-year lease. So we've got a long wait. But we know in 9 years' time, plus all the rent growth we're going to get naturally over the next kind of decade, there's a massive, like it's going to double in value in that case. So,
but it washes its face now. It's not costing you money to hold it.
Yeah, 7% day one. Okay. So it's good. But yeah, it'll effectively, that rent will you know, hopefully double in that period of time.
Whose job is it to remember the renegotiate the lease when it comes to you?
One of the guys in the syndicate. So, okay. And I'll be involved too. Like it's pretty easy. We'll just talk to the local managers. It's a long time. The market will change significantly there, but that's why 40% plus upside, there's fat in it. So
is that what you're waiting for? You think you get the capital growth there as an example?
Yeah, it's a big freehold property, you know, 5Ks from the CBD. Like you can't, I can't
what
see
sort
that.
Of businesses on it?
Well, it's Oak okay. the milk.
Oak, the company. Milk factory.
Yeah, and there's another a construction, but there's two tenants on it. So, yeah, big business. They got millions of dollars of fit out in there.
Like, I hope they're keeping you sweet with some chocolate milk or something or other.
Should hit them up.
Should do.
Down there.
Should do. That can be our sponsor. Why don't we get a sponsor? Sponsored by Oak Chocolate Milk. But, and so this question, you also spoke about tenant scheduling. I guess that's connected with the continuity of the lease, right, or the length of term of the lease that's left.
Yeah, so you just want to kind of make sure there's like market reviews at the end of the lease. Market reviews can go either way as well. So if you're in like the office environment, you're probably just happy with no market review at the moment. Just keep it going up 3% per annum. That's a good result. But yeah, you've got to understand that the rent as it goes up or down, and depending on how the lease is structured, can really dictate the capital growth you're going to get over the next decade.
Pretty good. Well, there's a thousand other questions here. We'll get them next. I think we should finish off every podcast moving forward with a Q&A, even if we have a guest. There's some questions you're going to ask a demographer, right? Which would be good, so stay tuned for that. That's good, Scott. It's good to get one-on-one. It's a long podcast, an hour.
Ready for
the punters want more, though. And you made the point, it was in jest around the popularity of your book, but, you know, it goes, we're 46 or so episodes in with this podcast. And I personally get the feedback, and I know you do, that just by doing this, it comes back to the point around education. So many more people have been exposed to commercial property as a result of our conversations on this podcast and therefore shaping their decision-making around it. So it's nice to do something positive for people. I hope it's been a positive outcome for people who listen to this. I haven't had too much negative criticism yet.
No, not yet. I think, it's just balanced advice. But, yeah, if you've got negative stuff,
it's not advice.
Bring it.
It's just commentary.
Let's hear it. Always like to improve.
And any questions at all, please send them through. Best way is?
It's info@rethinkinvesting.com.au. That's our direct email to the business. And, love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. And you've got another cohort of the education crew coming through. When's that?
Yeah, so that's happening in a few weeks' time. So we do about 3 a year. So we don't like too many clients in them all at once. So it can be quite personalised. And it's really good. Like they've all been catching up and getting together.
So like there's like a peer-to-peer thing. So like they catch up and have coffees together. And
yeah. So I think long-term, like people end up investing together and it just sort of creates the discussion outside of the podcast and, you know, internal to Rethink and that. So people can...
Are you going to do an event at some point? You're going to do you catch up with these people as sort of like, you know, hanging out and talking shop?
We'll do it all in the, like it's all over the internet. Like we literally do live Zooms and stuff almost weekly. So we do chat to them and answer their questions direct. So
sounds pretty good.
Good fun.
I'm sure you can get more info about that at info@rethinkinvesting.com.au. Scott O'Neill, thanks for your time, mate.
You too, Phil.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Remember, this is one of many podcasts that we've done. If there's any gaps in our schedule of podcasting you'd like us to talk about and doing Q&As, which we'll do a lot more of, so send them through. Allows us to fill those gaps. But anything specifically you want us to talk about, we're happy to do so. Just info@rethinkinvesting.com.au. We'll see you again next time. Until then, bye-bye.
The information featured in this podcast is general in nature and does not take into consideration your financial situation or individual needs and should not be relied upon. Before making any investment, insurance, tax, property or financial planning decision, you should consult a licensed professional who can advise whether your decision is appropriate for you. Guests appearing on this podcast may have a commercial relationship with the companies mentioned.